Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This episode of Groundwire was produced on unceded Mohawk territory in Montreal at CKUT. We're your hosts, Jessica Sharak
and Emily Ann Horning.
In this episode, a look into the planned expansion of Montreal's transit system and demonstrations on December 5th, International Day of Action in Solidarity with Water Protectors. But first, here are our headlines.
The Kurdish Students Association of York University organized tabling events over the last 2 weeks at York University and the University of Toronto campuses to collect signatures for a petition that demands that the Canadian government take action in response to the violent crackdown on Kurdish politicians and civil society leaders by the Turkish state. On November 4th, 11 MPs from the People's Democratic Party, HDP, were detained at their residences, including the co-chairs of the party, and arrest warrants have been issued for all 59 MPs. The HDP earned the votes of at least 6 million citizens and is the nation's third largest party. One of the organizers at the tabling event explains further.
Try and collect signatures for an online petition that we prepared, which hopefully will go to Justin Trudeau, and we're close to collecting about 1,000 signatures. It's for the People's Democratic Party in Turkey to ask for their release from prison. This is a democratically elected party in Turkey, the opposition party, the third largest one. The party is a pro-women, pro-LGBTQ, pro-minority, particularly the Kurdish minority party in Turkey.
The attacks are considered a continuum of the campaign against civil rights and liberties of the Kurdish people, using the pretext of the July 15th coup attempt and the suicide bombings in various parts of the country. Hundreds of people have died and tens of thousands have been displaced due to the military response and curfews in eastern provinces. Additionally, 170 media outlets critical of government policies have now been banned.
At the same time, there's just been, ever since the coup in Turkey in mid-July of last summer, there's been a huge crackdown on any sort of leftist opposition in Turkey. And this party, particularly under an umbrella of pro-women, pro-LGBTQ, pro-minority, particularly the Kurdish social movement, the Kurdish minority in Turkey, have, you know, gathered quite a substantial support base in Turkey, and anyone who's even remotely associated with them or with these progressive movements, leftist and Kurdish social movement, are facing wide-scale oppression.
Canada welcomes a new face to their currency, with civil rights activist Viola Desmond announced as the new face of the $10 bill. Desmond refused to move from her seat at a whites-only section of the cinema and was taken to court, where she was unjustly convicted of an unrelated and minor tax evasion. Desmond's stance against racial segregation in 1946 Nova Scotia contributed to the rise of the civil rights movement in Canada and was instrumental to the ending of the overt but not officially legal policy of segregation here in Canada. Desmond will become the first non-aristocratic woman and the first person of color to be given a portrait on Canadian currency.
Ricardo McRae, the founder of Black Excellence Platform Black in Canada, discussed the decision and its effects going forward with Groundwire National Coordinator Glenn S. of CIVL 101.7 FM.
Not how, but what do you think about the government's decision to place Viola Desmond's, a Canadian civil rights icon, really, on our $10 bill? And what you hope or what you think this will lead to in terms of a discussion on our very multicultural country.
It's going to lead to some discussion. the first black woman in Canada, first black woman, not only in Canada, but also in the United States, to be put on money. It's significant. Also on top of that she's an entrepreneur.
Yeah, she's a self-starter. She had her own business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's very, very fitting that an entrepreneur be the first person on money. And she's black. Like, she is a Canadian that is just as qualified as everybody else. It's not tokenism. It's just appropriate recognition of contributions from other people in our community, in our country, outside of white men.
So
like, they aren't the only people making things happen. Like, there are people from First Nation communities that are doing that deserve to be on there. There are people from South Asian, from Asian community. Like, all these communities contribute. when we overly focus on the fact that, you know, she's a black woman that's on there and that's the big achievement. I'm like, that's how she was born. It wasn't an achievement. The overarching thing that everybody wants to talk about is that their First Nationsness or their blackness or whatever it is, or the fact that it was a woman. And, oh, it's because she's like, what did she do? She didn't just like wake up one day and get on a $10 bill. She was flew to the States, you know, studied because she couldn't study in Canada, got certified, came back, started multiple companies, like trained 15 staff. Like, this woman was a hustler. Mm-hmm. She'd be on Shark Tank if she was around. You know what I mean? Like, she's that level of hustle. And that is very, very rare today. And it's that is why she's on there, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And it's just a beautiful bonus that she's a woman and that she's black.
The last International Aviation Day on December 7th was marked by the signature of accords between the ICAO and three educational institutions, McGill University, Dawson College, and UCAM, for a model UN exercise. This event was the perfect moment to come back on the ICAO environmental plan, since their 39th assembly had just met in October, to vote on measures to be taken by the aviation industry as a whole.
The organization, which is in charge of regulating world civil aviation, already supports the development of alternative fuels as they actively encourage the research in this sector. We interviewed Shane Johnston from Coalition Climat Montreal, who was present at the LAPS protest in October 2016 outside the ICAO headquarters.
They're a huge contributor to pollution, which means climate change. They're actually the equivalent, if you take all civil aviation together, it is polluting as if it were the seventh biggest country in the world, pollution-wise. That means it's like Canada's pollution, which is pretty shameful if you consider that we're actually the 38th largest population in the world, but we're the seventh polluter. So knowing that, we felt it was really important to make people aware of what was going on and also try to get the ears of the people involved in this to let them know that we wanted our ministers to be in there putting the survival of the planet and its people before economics. So the People's Coalition for Responsible Aviation, we coordinated internationally with other groups. So it wasn't as if we were doing this alone. It was coming from around the world, the interest and concern. There are specific countries and so on that signed on against what's happening in this industry. We're talking about complete countries have signed on to demands and agreements.
That's it for headlines. We'll be right back after this.
What would you say to people who are thinking about coming but out here to help, but they're on the fence about it?
Tell them to come. Fight your warrior spirit and get here.
We don't stand who will on earth. The wind comes in four corners, four directions, four colors. And death rides on four horsemen. A black snake with some black tanks. How much money do these companies need to make? They could drop their product, but they wanna save a buck. Already extracted billions, when is enough enough? I used to be in the oil fields, getting paid. But I quit, cause oil water I can't drink. Look down and see.
On December 5th, communities across Turtle Island gathered in response to a call to action from 12-year-old Autumn Pelletier of Wikwamekon to protect our water, stop pipelines, and in solidarity with Standing Rock.
What we're seeing now is there's a movement to actually like put real pressure on governments, including stopping things like pipelines that are going to increase emissions. So we had this protest on Monday. We had two women locked themselves to the front gates. You know, one of them was over 60 years old. She was there for her grandkids. We had five people enter the facility. Three of them climbed the big pipes that are used to load oil onto tankers there. That oil is coming from the Line 9 pipeline, which was reversed last year to carry basically tar sands oil from Alberta. And we do this to sort of show how strong the resistance is. It's also sort of these people are taking significant risks. They're facing serious legal charges. I think it's mischief and break and enter. We'll be in court in January over that. The oil and upstream oil and gas sector, so getting oil and gas out of the ground, is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Canada. It's more than all the tailpipes of all the cars, trucks, trains. It's more than electricity generation. It's more than buildings. It's the biggest source of greenhouse gas pollution in the country. And they're saying that between now and 2030, they expect that those emissions will actually increase by 35%. So national emissions as a whole are supposed to go down by 35%, but somehow the biggest chunk of that gets to grow by 35%. And that growth is driven by an 82% increase in greenhouse gas emissions from the tar sands. So basically, the tar sands are the fastest rising source of greenhouse gas emissions in Canada. And if we don't get those under control, then it's going to be really hard to achieve our national targets. But also, building things like new pipelines, you're actually locking in high emissions for decades to come. Once you build something, it's really hard. Once you spend $12 billion to build the energy pipeline, a lot of pressure to not shut it down, to keep it operating. There's also a question, however, of Indigenous rights. You have First Nations downstream from the tar sands operations who have been protesting for years, who have been taking the government to court in Alberta, like the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, which has sued Shell. It's taken the federal government to court, it's taken the Alberta government to court. And also First Nations along the pipelines route who are saying to Trudeau, you said you were committed to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. In that is a very clear acknowledgement that Indigenous people have the right to free, prior, and informed consent for projects taking place that are going to affect their lands and their culture. And you have now more than 120 First Nations and tribes who have said no to tar sands pipelines because of the threat it poses to water, to their culture, to the climate. And yet the Trudeau government is still pushing ahead with these.
Over 100 community members gathered on Fort William, First Nation Anishinaabe territory in Thunder Bay, shutting down a major intersection, the Harbour Expressway and Memorial, from 12 to 1 p.m. Water protectors round-danced in the intersection while jingle dress dancers danced in the center. Community members shared their experiences of traveling to Standing Rock over the last few months and spoke passionately about protecting the water and shutting down pipelines.
We will now again hear from Shane Johnston about REM, Réseau Électrique Métropolitain, a new train project which may pose economic and environmental problems. The REM is a new public transit network that would link downtown Montreal, the South Shore, the the West Island, the North Shore, and the airport using an electric light rail transit, LRT, system. For more information, both in English and French, go to transparence.ca.
I'm with Transparence, which is countering the REM, the new electric trains that are being basically shoved down our throats by Quebec, the Quebec Assembly, and by Montreal municipal government. Its purpose is to bring commuters in from the suburbs and therefore reduce congestion and pollution. But unfortunately, the whole process has been very muddy, very opaque. EDQ, the Caisse de dépôt et de placement Québec, they have simply handed off the decision-making process to get the project up and running and take care of it, which goes completely against the recommendations that came out of the Charbonneau Commission with respect to corruption. Their recommendation was to use in-house expertise. And here we are handing off everything to an investor. And this investor is being represented as le bas, where we keep our funds for a rainy day for all of Quebecers. And that's a very false representation. This group takes care of the placement for government employee pensions and teachers only. And their objective is, naturally, to earn as much benefit as possible for their pensioners. That's fine. But we don't want somebody with that objective investing in an essential public service, transportation, that many people cannot absolutely do without, and which is a good idea environmentally and for a multitude of reasons. We need a service that provides maximum service for a minimum investment. So it's a conflict of interest from the get-go, who's financing this. And then the project was handed off to a particular engineering company, SNC-Lavalin, I believe, and they made the plans and said, here it is. And the governments have said, okay, this is what we're going to do. They've had public consultations, BAP, Bureau d'Audience Publique, and also OCPM, Office de Consultation Publique de Montréal. So experts, industry, citizens have had the opportunity to go and talk about the problems with this project, but the government is not held to pay any attention to those recommendations. And I can assure you they're not. I mean, yes, if you say we want green instead of yellow handles on the doors or something or other, that's an easy fix. But the whole project in itself is a disaster. The environmental impact is terrible, I will explain. The finances make no sense. And with respect to service offers, it's not a good option either. So it's a win-win for who exactly? It seems to me it's win-win for the people that are interested in urban sprawl and are have decided to put down tracks in areas through agricultural land and have a whole new area that they can provide service to and have investment in with respect to immobilier, land. Financially, I explained why it's not a good idea that we have the Caisse de dépôt involved in this. I just learned that the project actually does not have the finances to go forward without seriously raising prices. So we're talking about maybe something equivalent to close to $60 added to everyone's income tax. Woohoo! or raising the rates, for example, coming in from Lake of Two Mountains, 70 cents per kilometer, which is very big. The other thing is, talking about finances, is that this project has is what's called a PPP, a private-public partnership.
Last week, the Task Force on Cannabis Legalization and Regulation presented its advice on a framework for legalization and regulation of access to cannabis to the federal government, following a move by the Liberals to introduce legislation that will see marijuana use legalized in Canada as early as June. Lobby groups across the country are also weighing in to determine what the face of a legal Canada will look like, but most agree the protection of children should be a key component of the eventual legislation. Currently in Nova Scotia, Injury Free Nova Scotia is conducting a series of public information sessions across the province to inform citizens of the issues at stake in developing this legislation, with the hope that the public will get involved in the consultation process. Todd Leader, a psychologist and mental health advocate, and author of the book, It's Not About Us, The Secret to Transforming the Mental Health and Addiction System in Canada, joins me now from his office in Halifax to discuss some of the implications.
The question is no longer whether or not. That's a done deal. The question is, though, how should we regulate it? That's the most important part. There's good evidence to say that if it's legalized, we actually have a better ability to protect our young people, but it's only if it's regulated the right way, if it's regulated in a way that truly puts the protection of our population above corporate interests. What does the research tell us are the effects of different types of regulation, so that people are aware of what we know from other jurisdictions that have done this and what we know from other substances like tobacco and alcohol to help reduce harms. So it's mostly going to be about that, sharing what the research is telling us and having discussions and answering questions, and just to get people kind of realizing this is what there is, this is what the research tells us, and hopefully sparking people to have an opinion and to express that opinion to their elected officials so that they get their words in there. Because at some point, regardless of the task force report, our members of parliament will have to vote on it. We know the kinds of things that need to happen. We need to take a public health kind of approach to this, which means we design regulations specifically for the purpose of protection and risk reduction, not for the purpose of generating revenue for either government or companies. Everybody is still going to make money. That's not a question. This is worth billions. If the government caves to lobbying from the industry and ends up creating a commercially driven, you know, profit-oriented, how do we maximize revenues for government, if those things are part of the consideration, we end up with a completely different model. In a commercialized kind of model, if you design regulations to favor profit and revenue for government and companies, then what that means is you allow advertising, for instance. Trudeau's government's goal is to reduce the risks and the harms that are happening now for cannabis, then certainly should not be designing legislation that actually promotes more use of the substance.
Publicly traded stocks of Canadian marijuana companies rose in value this week in conjunction with the task force's announcement. And on the TSX, shares of Canopy Growth, Canada's largest marijuana producer, rose by 7.9%. It is estimated that there are now at least 200 dispensaries operating, despite the fact that it is not yet technically legal to do so. Several licensed medical marijuana producers have also been developing avenues to add recreational sales to their list of services offered. These producers currently sell prescribed marijuana by mail, and many feel that this is a viable approach to distribution as it allows users in remote areas to access the weed they will now have the right to possess.
One of our worries, I think, generally is that the federal government, because it set a short timeline for itself, it will not complete the detailed design of legislation and regulations, but instead will defer some of those decisions and actually hand over some of that regulatory authority to the provinces. And that clearly would be a big mistake. That's the situation we have with alcohol right now. And if you go across Canada, the amount of harm, the amount of commercialization of it, it varies a lot. The age limits vary. And it takes on sort of the flavor of the day depending on what government gets elected and who's in power. And so if this federal government really wants to regulate in a way that protects our public, it needs to regulate and put it in place and not give regulatory authority to the provinces. We have the ability to design the right legislation, the right regulations that really will protect them, but will still honor the promise to make it legal.
The task force offered over 80 recommendations in total, and they can be found at healthycanadians.gc.ca. This is Sarah Newton reporting from QCCR 99.3 FM in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
Welcome to the sounds of CFUZ. We're coming to you from our brand new studio in Penticton, British Columbia, where we operate an online stream and continue to work towards our FM broadcast goal. I'm Jackie Del Rizzo, and I'm the president of the Peach City Community Radio Society. And here is our newly elected board of directors to let you know what we're up to and what we've got planned for the coming year.
I'm Andrew Druin, director at large. We spent the last year getting settled into our home at the historic Cannery Trade Center in the heart of Penticton, and have a few finishing touches to make this the space we want for community volunteers.
This is Suzanne McKinder, Communications Director. We're stepping up the training opportunities in the new year with introductory radio 101 sessions, as well as several hands-on workshops so that we can familiarize everyone with our equipment and our procedures.
I'm Claire Thompson, Vice President. This year we were recipients of a Community Radio Fund of Canada grant, which allowed us to hire our very first employee. She's been putting together structures and training materials for our volunteers.
Hey, I'm Lydia Frederick, the Francophone voice of the board, sitting as the membership director. For the first time this year, PGT Radio was a proud participant of Les Rendez-vous de la Francophonie. It was a great growing experience, and we're planning on repeating it next year.
Hi, I'm Ian McKinder, member at large and chair of the Music Committee. The committee is working on developing policies and procedures for the intake of music submissions. Part of that process is the development of a digital library. If you are a musical artist and are interested in having your music played on Peach City Radio, please send your music submissions to music@peachcityradio.org.
This is Andrew Dimma, the Society's treasurer for fiscal 2017. This year will be all about moving from podcast format to live streaming in order to help prepare us for FM radio. At the same time, we'll be installing an antenna and transmitter on site.
This is Dave Del Rizzo, Program Director and Technical Chair, Volunteer Coordinator for Peach City Radio. We're going to spend this year really cultivating our programmers and making the kind of programming that people want to hear in Penticton, as well as finishing up the final touches on our studio and making it a great environment and atmosphere for people to come in and make their live shows.
I'm Chris Millen, Peach City Radio Secretary. 2016 was a great year with a lot of effort put in by our volunteers through programming, events, and fundraising. We're definitely getting our group together for some holiday cheer in December to celebrate our progress.
That's all for now. We'll continue to keep you posted with our progress. Thank you to everyone who has helped us and guided us and cheered us on over the years. From CFUZ in Penticton, we wish all of our friends in community radio across the country a happy and healthy 2017.
You just heard The Stranger by Gord Downey.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced on unceded Mohawk territory in Montreal at CKUT.
Music this week was by A Tribe Called Red, Prolific the Rapper, and Gord Downey. Headlines this week were written by Ome Salma Rahimtula, Emmy Landre, and Glenn S.
We also thank Carly Forbes, Gretchen King, Braden Alexander, Aaron Lakoff, Janaba Dale, Mix Sweetman, and Sarah Newton.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio stations or download at groundwire.ca.